It's business time, baby.
The Solid Monster sounds off.
My client, Brock Lesnar, conquered the streak.
This doesn't make any sense.
Your title belt is made of leather. You're not a real vegan.
He's fat. You haven't been beat up properly. Woo!
Welcome to episode 478 of the Solid Monster Sounds Off. Here for Sunday, January 15, 2017. I am the Solid Monster. Hope everybody is having themselves a great weekend. We are coming off the WWE UK tournament, which, as I record this and post this in the next few hours, part two, the final half of the tournament, will be airing on the WWE Network. Because I didn't have a chance yet to watch part one yesterday, I did get some feedback from you guys. More feedback that a lot of people just didn't watch. Even WWE.com put a poll up, or at least on their Facebook page, and the result was not great in terms of did you watch the tournament? If so, what did you think? And all of that kind of stuff. And the overwhelming majority of people who voted in that poll seemed to indicate that they, in fact, did not watch the tournament. Which hopefully is not a bad omen for WWE, but I had other things going on. I couldn't watch it. So my plan is to settle in and try to watch the entire thing tonight. And if I'm able to do that, perhaps I'll be able to put up a sound off extra tomorrow. I make no guarantees. If not, I'll just cover it on the podcast next weekend. But yeah, by the time many of you listen to this podcast, we will have a brand new first ever WWE UK champion. I did see the belt, the UK championship belt. It's a beautiful belt. I think it's a beautiful design. If I had one knock on it and one criticism, I hate the fact that they're using the same shape. They're trying to fit all these new belts and these new designs into the same shape that the WWE title and the women's title has. I'm kind of over that at this point. So I wish they would be a little more creative with it. But for what it is, I think it's a beautiful belt. Certainly a lot better looking than some of the other titles they have produced over the years. This Thursday, January 19, is the deadline. It is the final day for voting in the Wrestling Radio Awards for 2017. This podcast, Solid Monster Sounds Off, is up for awards in four different categories, including Show of the Year. So you can vote for us for Show of the Year, but you can also vote for my interview with Bob Holly as the Male Interview of the Year, Carly Perez, a.k.a. Katrina from Lucha Underground, for Female Interview of the Year, and Diamond Dallas Page, one of the interviews I did with him under Media Interview of the Year. That's where you can find each of those things. You can vote once per day, every day between now and Thursday, one vote per category per day. WrestlingRadioAwards.com is the place to go, so I encourage everybody who would like to vote for the Sound Off to go ahead and do so, because these are the final days here. And then I think they're having an awards ceremony, or they're announcing the results on the 31st, and so that's when we will find out the winners and losers. So WrestlingRadioAwards.com, show some love for the Sound Off. You could also show some love for the Sound Off by using our Audible link, audibletrial.com/Solomonster. Get yourself a free audiobook on me. Death of WCW. A lot of books. I know one of you, RJ, if you're listening, I know she cashed in for one of the Chris Jericho books. So thank you for that. So you can use our Audible link and get a free book. Or you can make a PayPal donation on thesolomonster.com. Our PayPal VIPs are some of our biggest supporters. At thesolomonster.com, you'll see the PayPal button on the right-hand side. I want to say thank you to everybody who donated. These folks are the ones who donated at least 10 bucks or more this week. They got themselves a wrestling nickname, as you can, if you would like to hear your name called here on the show. I want to say thank you to John, Loose Cannon Lopez, Deadpool James Herrera, Yvonne Bruiser Balak, Beast Mode Brock Joseph, Out of Control Cody Thomas, The Florida Freebird, Bryant Becerra, The Reflection of Perfection Abraham Lara, there's a name I haven't heard on here in a while, Luis Hercules Hernandez, Eugene Crazy Eyes Morgan, The Philly Fanatic Colif Kane, Nemesis Nathan Moyers, Light 'Em Up Lamont Ambler, Kind of a Big Deal Corey Blake, The Human Torch Troy Smith, Velvet Revolver Robert Murray, Canadian Destroyer Rob Morrow, The Montreal Mauler Patrick Pacheco, Gavin Ghostface Rankin, Massgrave Micah Harshaw, Raymond the Mountie Medina, All Action Reginald Davis II, who is celebrating a birthday, by the way. Happy birthday, dude. The Hagerstown Hitman Jermaine Smith, Black Death Justin Hess, Macho Michael Anthony's, the Wheaton Warrior Nick McCarthy, and Stormin' Norman Wilson. And also Sven Pellman. Thank you to Sven. Thank you to everybody who donated this week. I very much appreciate the support. Speaking of support, got to give one last update here before we get into all the news, and that is on our Royal Rumble pool. Been talking about this now for a few weeks. The Royal Rumble, of course, is coming up on January 29th, I believe. Just repeating that offhand, I hope I'm right. So the Rumble pool that we've had going on our Facebook group, we've done this now 4 years. And Zach Holker, who's a big fan of the show, has taken it upon himself to run the pool now for the last few years. He has done an incredible job. So I want to give him all the kudos in the world because we've had an overwhelming response really the last couple of years, but this year more so. We are now up at last check over 1,600 participants in the Royal Rumble pool in our private group on Facebook. Somewhere around 1,650 and counting. We're not even done yet. We're going to break 1,700. Who knows where this may end? We are definitely going to best last year's record by over 1,000, which is incredible. And I also spoke to Zach after everyone's numbers are assigned, and he's assigning the random numbers to everybody next Saturday, January 21st. He's going to put that in a separate post, but just so you know, people can still like the original Facebook post, which is pinned still to the top of the group on Facebook. It may not be for a few hours once this podcast goes up. I usually pin the podcast. But if you don't see the post, it's very simple. Just do a search in the group for Zach Holker's name. Z-A-C-K-H-O-L-K-E-R. You will find the original Rumble post. All you need to do if you want to participate and have some fun with this is like the post. You don't have to, you know, post a comment or anything. Just like the original post. He will see it. He will add your name to a pool. We have something like 50 pools going now. So if you're not in, you still have time. Zach said that signups will not stop until a few hours before the pay-per-view on the 29th. And so you've got time to still sign up if you want to. The one caveat here is that we must have 30 people in a pool. And so if you wait too long, if you sign up and then we end up at the very end with a pool that only has 29 people or 15 people, you're out of luck because you can't participate in a pool that doesn't have 30 people to correspond with 30 men in the Royal Rumble. So that's the only caveat there. We're offering, I've mentioned this before, the winner of the pool, it's all in good fun, but the winner of the pool, I will buy them a Sound Off shirt of their size and of their choosing. So you get a free Sound Off shirt. You get a shout out here on the podcast. I also learned this week, our good friend Matt from superkickfoundation.org is going to throw in a free Superkick shirt, hoodie, or tank top to the winner. So you're getting even more swag here if you win the Royal Rumble pool. So get in on that. If you're not in the Facebook group, you have to apply for membership. I will approve you. Shoot me a message on Facebook as well, just so I know you're not a bot. You are. It's funny, I've gotten so many messages this week, and I'm kind of a smartass. So I've gotten so many messages this week from people saying, I am human. And I respond back, and I'm like, cool, me too. It's just such a weird message to get, but that's the kind of thing you need to do. I just want to make sure that everything is on the up and up. There are some spam requests that make their way into the queue. Which is why sometimes people get lost in there. I have people emailing me and messaging me saying, dude, I've been in the queue for over a year. I had one guy say he's been in the queue for almost 2 years. I felt like such a shithead. I'm like, dude, you should have let me know. Just send me a message, or you can cancel if you applied and were just sitting there. Just cancel and reapply. It'll knock you back up to the top of the list, and I'll get you on in there. We've got over 5,100 people in there. I want to keep that number going up. So get in on that. That's always a lot of fun. Let's get into Monday Night Raw. And there is some news this week. I know there was some news in The Observer that kind of caught fire this week as it concerns The Undertaker and the WrestleMania card changing. There really is no big top story, so I'm incorporating some of that news into the Raw review. So if you are not a Raw fan, you might want to listen to the review anyway, because I'm going to get into some stuff here. But Raw last Monday was live from New Orleans, Louisiana. Let me tell you, I said last week, you know, when they made it official, actually they made it official here on this show. They ran a commercial for it, but, WrestleMania, of course, is coming back to New Orleans. It is coming back to the Superdome in 2018. I'm very excited about this. I had the, time of my life in New Orleans a few years ago, over there on Bourbon Street, not just walking on Bourbon Street. We actually had a house on Bourbon Street. And so as soon as I found out that WrestleMania was coming back to New Orleans, I sent a message to Noah. I said, dude, you should get back in touch with that hookup. You should get back in touch with that person who got us the house and see if it's available. And we'll put some money down now and we'll reserve it, because we're going. Like, this is not a question here. We're going. And, yeah, we already got things all set up. So it's funny to me, because we don't even have our hotel booked yet for WrestleMania this year in Orlando, but we're already booked for our house next year in New Orleans. So you could tell I'm kind of excited. But this show, not so exciting. Twitter poll, 27% thumbs up, 73% thumbs down out of 2,100 votes. So again, Raw, not impressing. And for good reason this week. I know it's hard to believe. I do try to be as fair-minded and polite sometimes anyway as I can be, looking for things on the show that I like. And there's always something on the show that you can like, even if it's just one segment or one thing that happened. I have to say this week, though, Raw was the Stephanie McMahon show. And whenever Raw is the Stephanie McMahon show, it always sucks. And she was at her absolute dirt worst this week on this show. Just to an infuriating degree. Channel-changing heat with me, this woman had. That backstage segment alone with Bayley and Sasha Banks, and you know which one I'm talking about if you watch the show. That segment alone, let me say this, that had better lead to a match at WrestleMania with Stephanie tapping out to the bank statement. And even if it does, this was still an awful segment, and it was such a great, it was like a microcosm, it was a snapshot of everything that is wrong with this Stephanie McMahon character. She did it to the men, she's done it to a few women before, she dressed down Charlotte a long time ago, and now she's doing it to the other women. No one is safe. No one is safe from the reach of this woman. This woman is just... it's unbelievable sometimes how she can drag down the show. And Stephanie, it's not like she's a bad actress. You know what I mean? Like, when it comes to promos and stuff, Stephanie can actually be pretty good. But it's just incredible to me the negative impact that this woman's character has, how she brings this show down, brings it to a screeching halt. It's bad enough when she's using that voice and she's screaming and she's screeching about something. But I'm talking more about the impact that she has on the other players on this show. And you think, well, I've heard her in interviews before say, you know, well, my character is a bad guy. And my character exists on the show to help get others over. It was some variation of that. She was trying to say that basically her character on Raw, the reason that the character exists and what she tries to do is actually help get other people over and make them more popular. And I laughed because I thought to myself, you know, in theory, that sounds well and good, right? The evil bitch boss who is dressing someone down or yelling at someone or throwing roadblocks and obstacles in their way. And in the end, the babyface perseveres. First of all, how often does that even happen? And second of all, it doesn't help when we have segments like this week to week on this television show and you're waiting for a payoff that may or may not ever come. That's why I said at the very least, it's better lead to a match at WrestleMania with her tapping out, because, and I know I should know better than that. I've said this about other things before. Well, hopefully Stephanie gets her comeuppance in the end, and rarely, if ever, does that happen. So I know it's pretty stupid of me to actually assume that that's where this is leading to. But I made the comment a few weeks ago, and some people, I had one person email me this morning, and they said, Do you still feel the same way that you felt a week or two ago when you made the comment about how Stephanie McMahon is the perfect foil for Bayley, right? And I still feel that way. I still feel that way. Even after this segment, I still feel that if used properly, Stephanie McMahon can be the perfect foil for Bayley. I have not changed my mind on that. In fact, the comment I made was, if we must have this woman on this show, and I wish we didn't. But if Stephanie has to exist on this show as the evil heel authority figure, and we have to put up with her, then this is the best role for her. Bayley in particular, not Sasha, it's the Sasha thing that pissed me off. Bayley is a different kind of cat, right? I'm Steve Austin now. She's a different kind of character. She's somebody who, you know, you can really turn her into even more of a sympathetic figure by having Stephanie say, you don't belong here. Look at you. You're like a little girl. You don't belong with the rest of these women on this show. And just make people hate her and want to see Bayley get her revenge on Stephanie. Whether it's in a match, doesn't have to be against Stephanie in a match. You know, Stephanie can set up some other kind of scenario heading into WrestleMania where maybe even Bayley's spot on the Raw roster is on the line. I mean, you can come up with some different ideas. But in the end, Bayley proves that she does belong. And she puts Stephanie in her place. Doesn't have to be in a match. I still feel that way, absolutely. Are they going to do that? I have no idea. But when I saw what they did with Sasha, Sasha's a completely different character than Bayley. Sasha walks around with all this bling and the chains and the rings and I'm the boss. The boss of what? I don't know. And you see Stephanie on the show basically yelling at them like they're a couple of school kids and saying, well, you think you're the boss. I'm the real boss around here. And I'll talk about the segment later. I mean, it makes me sick. You know, when I see this woman on the show and I see the way that she interacts with these people, like everybody is beneath her and get out of my office and get out of my hair, get out of my face, get out of my life. And I just think to myself, you know, who exactly is benefiting from this? I know it makes Stephanie McMahon look like this great, you know, powerful female executive. Who gives a fuck? You know what I mean? When I'm watching this TV show, I don't give a shit if you're a powerful male executive. I don't give a shit if you're a powerful female executive. I don't care if you're a powerful eunuch. I don't care if you're a powerful person who thinks they're both male and female. I don't care if you're a she-male, if you're a tranny, or what the hell you consider yourself to be. I don't care. I don't find this entertaining at all. And I don't see who it's benefiting. So this female power bullshit, you know, when it comes to the TV show, who cares? Mick Foley, it ain't like he's much better. He was castrated by her a long time ago. I don't even know what purpose he serves on this show. Why do we even need Mick Foley on this show? Stephanie's always out there. Shane is sometimes out there on SmackDown. More often than not, we see Daniel Bryan, which makes sense. He appointed Daniel Bryan to be his general manager. Everywhere Mick Foley goes, Stephanie is right there. It's like Stephanie is his tail. They're like attached at the hip. They're attached at Mick's bad hip. Why even have him out there? Why not just get it over with, have her fire him on TV, slap the shit out of him, and just be done with it already? Because frankly, I don't have a need for either one of them on the show. The stuff with The Undertaker was just weird. They spent all week promoting the fact that he would be on Raw, only to change their whole storyline to, well, we don't know if he's going to show up or not. And it led to Stephanie giving Mick Foley a performance review. And this just ties in with what I was just talking about. And we've had these performance reviews before, right? They build them throughout the show. Are we going to fire the GM? Am I not going to fire the GM? Who cares? Who possibly cares? So she's going to have a performance review for Mick Foley. She's already threatening to fire him. Good. At this point, again, like I said before, it would be a mercy killing. I wish she would already. I wish they would both go. Now, on the flip side, because it wasn't all bad, it was mostly bad, but it wasn't all bad. Chris Jericho did win the United States Championship in that handicap match, match number 48, I believe, with Kevin Owens against Roman Reigns. Of course, that should make both of them the United States champions, since it was a handicap match. Under the normal rules of a handicap match, they would both be the U.S. champion, I would think, since it wasn't a triple threat. But whatever, they make up the rules as they go along. The end for Roman Reigns came when Kevin Owens powerbombed him outside the ring. on the apron, rolled him inside, fed him right into a codebreaker by Jericho, and Jericho got the pin. So Jericho has now won every major championship that there is to win. Very impressive. Speaking of the new champ, good guy Chris Jericho struck again this week. Tim Smith, who was one half of the tag team Well Done in WWE, back in the mid-90s when they brought in a bunch of Smoky Mountain guys under shitty gimmicks. He also went by the name of Rex King in other promotions. He passed away this week at the age of 55, complications from kidney failure. His family set up a GoFundMe page to help pay for his funeral expenses. Unfortunately, when you hear a lot about these wrestlers, they're destitute. They've fallen on hard times. The medical bills start to pile up and they end up with nothing. And this is unfortunately a story that has been told over and over and over and over again. One can only hope, fast forward 15, 20, 25 years from now, that this generation is smarter with their money. And sometimes it's not even a matter about being smart. You can be smart with your money, and one car accident, you know, you're only one accident away from being bankrupted. That's just the way it is. And these guys, just the nature of what they've done for a living for so many years, they beat their bodies to shit. Whether they're in an accident or it's just an accumulation of injuries over the course of a career, anybody who knows anything when it comes to medical and insurance and all that kind of stuff, you can be smart with your money, you can save and scrimp and invest and all that kind of stuff, and you can still get fucked over in the end. So I don't want to pass any judgment on this guy. The fact is, the family needs money to help pay for his funeral expenses. They were looking to raise $2,500, and Chris Jericho stepped up under his real name to donate the full amount. He paid for the entire thing. I mean, more money was also paid by other people on top of what was asked for, but Jericho paid the full amount all by himself. And this is far from the first time that Jericho has done this. He posted a very nice note, too. He said Rex was a good guy who always was good to me, and hopefully he's found peace. He's with the Lord now. But again, not the first time that Jericho has stepped up to support another wrestler in their time in need. I'm sure you saw that very depressing video that Perry Saturn posted on Facebook this week. He's asking for people to give to his GoFundMe page because he may end up homeless in the next few weeks. Which is terrible. He's got a lot of health issues right now, brain trauma. You can kind of tell just watching him speak. I mean, I saw it. Saturn was off the map. He was off the radar for a long, long time. And the first interview in a long time I saw him do was many months ago. He did an interview at one of these conventions with Bill Apter, who I've interviewed Bill on the show before. Bill is a wrestling treasure. And he's friends with a lot of guys, and he was very excited to be able to talk to Perry, and Perry had resurfaced not too long ago. And that was the first time that Saturn publicly admitted that he was going through some brain issues and a traumatic brain injury. And you can kind of tell. Like, I don't think it's some kind of, BS story or anything like that. You just watch Saturn and watch him and listen to him speak, and you could tell that there's something off there, that something's wrong with the guy. And it's a shame. It really is a shame to see. His GoFundMe page has been around now for a few months. And the point of all this is that Chris Jericho has already given $5,000 to help out his friend. $5,000 he's dropped on Perry Saturn's GoFundMe campaign. He donated $2,500 to Axel Rotten to pay for his medical bills when he was still alive. He donated $2,000 to help Jerry Lynn pay for his neck surgery. He's given money to Sabu. He's given money, I believe, to the Dynamite Kid. It's a very cool thing for him to do. You know, so no matter how much he may want people to hate him, it's hard to do when you see stuff like that. So with the U.S. title now off of Roman Reigns no longer has to carry that giant paperweight over his shoulder. It would seem to all but guarantee that he's getting the Universal title. If not at the Royal Rumble, then probably at Fastlane. I think it'll be at the Rumble, so that he can go into WrestleMania as the defending champion. But this plays into what's going on with The Undertaker. So The Undertaker did show up on this show, and thus he saved Mick Foley's job in the process. So a heel move there by the dead man. He officially entered himself into the Royal Rumble match. This year marks the 10-year anniversary of his lone Royal Rumble win back in 2007. And according to an item in the latest Wrestling Observer newsletter, it looks like the plan for Undertaker to wrestle John Cena at WrestleMania, which had been the plan. It had been the plan last year, too, before Cena hurt his shoulder. That plan is now off the table. Vince McMahon has just up and changed his mind. And according to Meltzer's report, he will not be facing John Cena, nor will The Undertaker be wrestling for any championship on this show, nor will he be wrestling Braun Strowman, despite that little tease they did on this show where he was talking in the ring and they did the cutaway to the backstage area where Braun was kind of watching him on a monitor. And at first I'm like, oh no. I like Braun Strowman. He's progressing nicely, but the idea of a Braun Strowman Undertaker match at WrestleMania, no thank you. So it will not be Strowman, but according to this report, Undertaker will be wrestling somebody from the Raw brand at WrestleMania. Now, if we assume that Roman Reigns is getting the Universal title, that would seem to eliminate Roman Reigns as a possibility if Undertaker is not wrestling for a championship. And that's been the other rumor. It's going to be Undertaker and Roman Reigns. I don't know. Maybe it will be. I'm going by this report, if it's accurate, and if Roman wins the championship from Kevin Owens, be it this month or next month or whenever, it ain't going to be Roman Reigns, right? So let's put him on the side. We already know that Goldberg and Brock Lesnar are going to have their rematch. And by the way, it looks like that match may actually headline WrestleMania. I don't know if I believe that. That's something where even if it is the plan right now, I think it'll change a million times between now and then. And so I don't really want to get into a debate about that until we get a better sense of whether or not that's legit or not, because I'll have some thoughts on that. But the point is, Goldberg and Lesnar are going to have their match on that show, so it wouldn't be either one of them facing The Undertaker. Seth Rollins is obviously going with Triple H. And boy, has Rollins cooled down over the last month or so. I mean, it really is not all that surprising, I guess, because this is what happens when the guy that you're feuding with does not show up on television for months. And you can blame football, Triple H, it's football season, of course he's not going to show up, whatever the excuse. We have not seen Triple H on TV pretty much since he screwed over Seth Rollins on that Raw back on August 29th. And so what's supposed to be this hot feud, how are you supposed to progress it if the other party never shows up on TV, never mails in a taped promo? Nothing. The feud has been on ice just so they can get to this point. So maybe in the Rumble, if Triple H screws over Rollins, they can heat this thing back up and it'll be a hot feud. We'll see. But for now, this thing is ice cold. And it has not done Seth Rollins any favors because he, as one of the top babyfaces on the Raw brand, just feels like another guy floating around aimlessly waiting for something to happen. And I'm not sure that that's what they had in mind for Seth Rollins, but that's what's happened. So Rollins, though, has an opponent set for WrestleMania. And then when it comes to Kevin Owens and Chris Jericho, it sure does look like those two are going to be wrestling for the U.S. title. So if all of this is accurate, that would take Braun Strowman, Bill Goldberg, Brock Lesnar, Roman Reigns, Seth Rollins, Kevin Owens, and Chris Jericho off the table as potential WrestleMania opponents for The Undertaker. But again, Meltzer's report says he's wrestling a Raw guy. If that's the case, I can see Roman defending the championship against Braun Strowman, or, and I like this idea better, or possibly even Samoa Joe. If Samoa Joe, as I believe he will, debuts in the Royal Rumble match, and I've always said that I think Joe would be a Raw guy. If Nakamura comes up, I see him as a SmackDown guy, but if Joe comes up, I see him being on the Raw brand. I could see a situation where Samoa Joe debuts in the Royal Rumble match or on Raw the next night. I always had him pegged for the Raw brand, and my idea last year, in fact, was for him to debut, if you remember, as Triple H's hired gun from NXT to take on Roman Reigns at WrestleMania instead of doing the match that they did do, which was a dud, which was Roman and Triple H, predictably, in the WrestleMania main event, and it was far from the best match on the card, hardly one of the best WrestleMania main events that I've ever seen, but that was the idea that I pitched for 2016, that Joe comes in, but he's one of Triple H's NXT boys. He's like his heavy, his body, not his bodyguard, his hired gun, and you could have done Roman and Joe, you know, a short program with them heading into WrestleMania last year. Well, why not do it this year? You know, Triple H doesn't have to be involved. I guess that wouldn't be part of the storyline because Triple H is doing his thing with Rollins, so he doesn't have to come in as a hired gun, but he could debut in the Rumble or the next night. And to be honest with you, in some ways, I like that just as much as the idea of Joe being a surprise in the Rumble match. Because Joe could be a surprise in the Rumble match, and you think, okay, we don't know what brand he's on. Is it just a one-off? And then the next night on Raw, let's say Roman wins the title at the Rumble. The next night on Raw, we have no sense of who his next challenger is going to be. You know, Kevin Owens, I'm sure, will get his rematch, and we'll get match number 57 between them. But you can have a situation where Joe just lays him out at the end of the show, and it makes very clear that Joe is going to go after the championship heading into WrestleMania. And that's all you need. You don't need any kind of Triple H tie-in to set that program up for WrestleMania. So I like that idea, and we'll see if that's the direction they go in. Because if Joe debuts in the Rumble, I want him to be involved in something big. And it doesn't get any bigger than being involved in a championship program. If Joe debuts and now he's on Raw, what do you do with him heading into WrestleMania? If everybody else is all tied up, you're just going to put him in the Andre Battle Royal? I mean, what a fucking waste of the guy that would be. So a program with Roman, to me, would make a lot of sense. So as far as Reigns goes, there's an idea for him. As far as The Undertaker goes, you take away all of those guys. Who the hell is left on that Raw brand for him to face? Well, there's only one name left that I see, and that's the Demon, Finn Balor. Balor has said that a return at the Rumble is unlikely. Doesn't mean it won't happen. He could be a surprise, but it sounds like from all the things I've read that he will be cleared, he will be ready by March. And again, a shoulder tear, a shoulder injury, Hideo Itami is a great example of this. You don't fuck around with that. That's not something that you rush back from. John Cena can rush back in 3 months from a torn pec because he's not human. Most other people, we're normal human beings with normal muscles and tissue and blood and all that kind of stuff. And, you know, WWE, I could see them not wanting to take a chance. Maybe Balor feels like he can come back now. But if we assume he will not be cleared for competition until March, he would be back technically in time to be on the WrestleMania card. Although by then, it's kind of too late to kind of inject him into the championship picture or do a lot of things with him because it's kind of late in the game. So if he can be on the WrestleMania card, what do you do with him? Well, a match with The Undertaker, you don't really need to do much to set that thing up. In fact, Balor doesn't even have to wrestle on TV before WrestleMania. Mania could be his official in-ring return. I mean, you can put him on TV, you can hype it up with promo packages and stuff. You can do a face-to-face maybe between them on TV. He doesn't have to wrestle. You know, a Mania match with Undertaker could be his first official match back. And the thing sells itself in terms of the advertising. The Dead Man and the Demon. Two of the darkest characters in the entire company. Old versus new. Big versus small. I like a lot of the dynamic there. You know, I remember the first time somebody floated that idea, probably was a couple of years ago at this point. I really wasn't sold on it. But the more I think about it now, and the idea that I have for it, I'm totally on board with this. The more I think about this. I like this a lot. The whole Demon versus Dead Man attraction at WrestleMania. Now, the same people who had a problem with CM Punk as a believable opponent for The Undertaker at WrestleMania 29 because of how small Punk was compared to Undertaker, those people, I'm sure, are gonna hate this idea because Balor's even smaller than Punk is, right? Some people just can't get over the whole size differential there. I personally have no problem with it. And by the way, Undertaker and Punk had the best match on that entire show. So I don't really want to hear any of that size bullshit here when it comes to this because this could be a big attraction at WrestleMania. Okay. I'd much rather see this than Undertaker against Braun Strowman. Can you imagine Undertaker even attempting at this stage to lift Braun Strowman up for a tombstone? What a dumpster fire of a match that would probably end up being. Just the entrances alone, Balor and Undertaker is an attraction. Now, I have no idea if that's the new plan or not. Just by reading these rumors and by process of elimination, I'm putting two and two together here and I'm saying, okay, if all these pieces line up and it's not this guy and he's not wrestling for a title and Balor said he'll be back in March, you know, I'm a reasonably smart guy. I'm just putting two and two together here and I'm saying this makes a lot of sense. This makes a lot of sense. And the more I think about it, the more I like it. Balor, you know, my idea is this. If they do the match, I've said before, I think Balor ought to go heel. I still think that hooking him up with Gallows and Anderson, you know, they've got the chemistry. They've worked together before. Gallows and Anderson are just, I don't even know anymore with those two. They're just two guys, you know, they're just two guys on the roster. They weren't when they first came in. Yeah, they kind of made them out to be a big deal. They were running around with AJ Styles. They were attacking Roman Reigns. They were doing big things. And it just, the brand split happened. And that was almost like the nail in the coffin for those guys. And they've just been treading water ever since. Karl Anderson won a singles match on TV 2 weeks ago. I thought the world was coming to an end. I couldn't believe it. How did we get to this point where Karl Anderson wins a TV match and it's one of the most shocking things of the entire year? That's kind of sad. And so I'm sure they would love to work with Balor. Balor would love to work with them. They're not doing anything. They're not doing much. It just put them together. And you do the match at WrestleMania with Undertaker and with Balor. And if Undertaker has to win, that's cool. Let him win. Let him get the win. I know it would be Balor's first match back, but it's okay because I would turn him heel. And sometimes it's okay to beat the guy if he's just going to turn after the fact, because that's all people are going to remember. If Balor loses to The Undertaker at WrestleMania, and that night or the next night or whatever, he comes out and he's a heel and they're throwing up the two sweet, him and Anderson and Gallows, people aren't even going to remember what happened at the end of that match at WrestleMania. They're going to think, all right, we got a new heel faction here on this show running roughshod. That's what people are going to remember. So you can have Undertaker beat Balor. Balor goes to pay his respects when the match is over. Anderson and Gallows show up to attack The Undertaker, and people don't know exactly why. What are they doing? You know, why are they doing this? And Balor ends up aligning with them and turning himself heel in the process. And all three of them beat The Undertaker down. So even though Balor loses, that last visual is of him standing tall. And again, that's all that matters. And you've just created a new heel group on the Raw brand. And I don't know, from my point of view, beating down The Undertaker ain't a bad way to get yourself a ton of heel heat right out of the gate. So that's my take on the whole Undertaker situation. I like that idea a lot, and if Balor's going to be back in time for Mania, there's really no better idea, I think, than to do the Demon versus Deadman idea. Shawn Michaels also appeared on this show. If you thought he might have been there to promote some kind of role for himself at the Alamo Dome for the Rumble, then you probably hated this segment. He did mention winning the title from Sid there in 1997, but he quickly moved on to the real reason why he was on the show, which was to promote his new movie, The Resurrection of Gavin Stone, which was met by silence. Rusev and Lana and Jinder Mahal came out. Rusev wanted Lana to be in the film, but Sean said, well, we already finished production on it. I would sure hope so, since the thing comes out in a week. Rusev said, well, we could use CGI like they did in the Star Wars movie. And this was all comedy. Rusev saved the entire thing. Rusev was awesome here. When I see him in segments like this, like his matches are fine. They can be a little boring, but Rusev is a good wrestler. But I am entertained as all hell when I see him in segments like this. And so he was great. Enzo rolled out in a wheelchair with Big Cass. They had more comedy. This dragged on way too long. Way too long. The payoff to all of this, by the way, this long segment and all of this comedy, the payoff was a match between Big Cass and Jinder Mahal. All I can say is, I want my money back. I didn't even pay for anything. I just want my money back. Sean said he would stay at ringside for the match and then said, I've got two words for everyone. And only Shawn Michaels could show up on TV to promote a Christian film and end his segment by getting 10,000 people to chant, suck it, at him. Only Shawn can get away with that. So, of course, Rusev during the match ate a super kick on the outside. Cass dropped Jinder when he went for the East River Crossing and pinned him with the Empire Elbow. This was not good. Then we had the backstage segment with Stephanie dressing down Sasha and Bayley. They wanted a match next week with Charlotte and Nia Jax, who had attacked them earlier in the show, savagely beaten them down. And so they wanted a match next week, and Stephanie told Sasha, your shirt may say legit boss, but I'm the only boss around here, and your match is tonight, not next week. Now get the hell out of my office. And it wasn't until after the show on Twitter that Sasha responded, although not directly. She didn't even tag Stephanie, but she posted a tweet and she said, "You may write my checks, but I make you the money." Ha 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 ha. What guts, right? What guts for the Sasha Banks character to stand up to Stephanie McMahon by posting a tweet after the show is already over. Whatever. Anyway. At least Undertaker stood up to her when he was out there. Because Stephanie was out there for the Undertaker segment with Mick Foley, and Undertaker said, I answer to no one. No one controls the Undertaker, he said. And then he made it a point to look right at Stephanie, and he said, not even you, or... He just made it a point to look at Stephanie when he said that, and I was amazed that Stephanie didn't even roll her eyes or, you know, kind of get the last word in there or anything. She just stood there and actually looked stunned for a change. And if it was anybody else in the ring, you know that she would have had the last word or she would have rolled her eyes or smirked or something, right? Not even Dusty Rhodes could have gotten away with that. Remember that? Swatting his hand away when he dared put his hand up in her face. And then I don't think he was on TV again after that. Backstage, Noam Dar finally got his kiss from the lovely Alicia Fox. Right? That's my Noam Dar impression. This led to a match with Dar and Cedric Alexander, her boyfriend, on 205 Live, where Alicia accidentally cost Cedric the match, and then he broke up with her backstage after. And Alicia proceeded to have the greatest meltdown in the history of meltdowns, to the point where you could see her corpsing on camera as she dropped to her knees. The New Day came out for a segment with Titus O'Neil, which led to them replaying footage from NXT about 7 years ago, back when they had guys like Eli Cottonwood cutting freestyle promos about how he doesn't have a mustache, even though he did. This was footage of Titus running with a keg and tripping and falling over himself like a goober. And so what they were going to do here was they were going to give Titus O'Neil an opportunity to make up for that mistake. They were going to reenact that and put a keg in his hand and give him a chance to run. And you got to cross a finish line. I watched this and it made me angry all over again about that Bring It to the Table show and their discussion of 3-hour Raws. So I took Paul Heyman's advice and I boycotted the rest of this segment and I skipped to the main event, which is where Chris Jericho and Kevin Owens beat Roman Reigns to win the United States Championship, which I already talked about. Jericho is now the U.S. champ. I don't believe that Kevin Owens' championship is going to be safe come Royal Rumble time. We'll see, but Jericho will be hanging above the ring in a shark cage, and I have a feeling that Jericho will accidentally on purpose cost Kevin Owens the championship, but we shall see. This was not a good show. This was not a good show. That clean slate I said I was giving Raw when the year started out has dog shit smeared all over it now, and I can't seem to clean it off. SmackDown Live, meanwhile, on the A Show, they were live from the Raising Cane's River Center Arena in Baton Rouge. Now, you see, that's actually a pretty cool name. Raising Cane's is apparently a chicken finger franchise down there. I'm already making a list for New Orleans next year. Hopefully they have one in town so we can check it out. But Raising Cane's, just call it the Raising Cane's Arena. That's actually a pretty cool name. Twitter poll for SmackDown. 1,500 plus votes. 88% thumbs up. 12% thumbs down. Another real good show, save for that women's match with Carmella and CJ Lundy. What a horrendous segment that was. I haven't seen a downward spiral that bad since WCW in 99. Lundy apparently goes by the name Thunder Kitty and has wrestled for Shimmer before. Hopefully she looked a lot better there than she did here, because this was awful. James Ellsworth was out there and he caused a distraction which led to Carmella winning with the Code of Silence. I know I'm skipping around here, but that was probably the worst segment on the show. From there, It was much better elsewhere. I like the Ambrose Asylum that actually, I think, opened the show with Miz and Maryse, where Ambrose handed Miz a participation award for losing the Intercontinental Championship to Dean Ambrose. Miz had done the same thing to Ambrose when he lost to AJ Styles. So this was a nice callback to that. The match with Nikki Bella and Natalya never happened because Natalya attacked Nikki and went after her leg. So that storyline is progressing. Hot off his heel turn last week when he super kicked Kalisto after losing to Baron Corbin. Dolph Ziggler continued his losing ways, losing to Kalisto off a crucifix pin. Ziggler was acting kind of cocky, went for a very nonchalant pin, he got rolled over. Ziggler clotheslined Kalisto when the match was over, beat him down with a steel chair. Apollo Crews ran out to make the save, and he looked like a total loser. He got cut off immediately before Ziggler beat him down with a chair. Ziggler losing is not a big deal. It further solidified the turn. This was more of like, okay, this guy has officially turned. He's gone off the deep end. He's beaten up two baby faces now, and this was no mistake. So it served a purpose. That's fine. Apollo Crews, though, he really did look like an idiot out there. That did not do him any favors. American Alpha retained their tag team titles over Randy Orton and Bray Wyatt after another miscommunication involving Orton and Luke Harper. Orton once again was the one to eat the pin from Chad Gable. This was good stuff. This was a good match. Afterwards, Bray tried to keep the peace between the two of them. He was accidentally mule kicked in the gut by Luke Harper, and then he walked out in disgust. So there is turmoil in the Wyatt family. I'm sure that will play itself out in the Royal Rumble match. Daniel Bryan told Becky Lynch and Alexa Bliss that they would have a match for the women's title next week, and it would be contested inside a steel cage, which Bliss was not happy about. And on Talking Smack after the show, the two of them, they were both on at the same time. They had some words back and forth. And Becky Lynch, who is the queen of puns, right? This woman's entire life is just one giant pun. It's one giant play on words. This may have been her best one yet. She very low-key told Alexa when Alexa stormed off and Becky went to go leave, she said to Alexa, "See you next Tuesday." Now, maybe she meant it literally, as in, I will see you next Tuesday, because that is the night of our show. That is when the show airs on TV. Or you can take a trip on over to the Urban Dictionary and realize that was no coincidence. But it was quite glorious, I must say. Hopefully she doesn't get any heat over it. She wasn't the only one with a play on words on Tuesday. Mara Rinaldo, on SmackDown, this was coming off the big Trump news, all that disgusting shit that broke that day. He said that AJ Styles' first year in WWE has been golden, and he has been showered with praise for his in-ring performances. Fake news or not, I thought that was well played. But I can see Vince really not appreciating that one very much. And with Tom Phillips sitting about 18 inches over to his right, I might choose my words a little more carefully next time. And in the main event, John Cena pinned Baron Corbin with an attitude adjustment. Now, I can't say that I was too thrilled to see Corbin go down so easily to the five knuckle shuffle AA combo. Not a fan of that. But the fact is, John Cena is the one challenging for the championship at the Royal Rumble, and not Baron Corbin. And so that outcome was the correct one. Corbin did take most of the match. He looked pretty dominant. Styles was out there on commentary. There was a funny moment where Corbin gave Cena the old Kevin Nash sidewalk slam. Actually, Kevin Nash, Kane, and that would make sense, because I've heard reports that Kane has kind of taken Baron Corbin under his wing in some ways backstage. He's been giving him tips and advice, and look, I can't think of a better big man to learn from on that roster than Kane. I think that's a great role for him to be in. And that's a move that you see Kane use a lot in his matches. So he gave him the sidewalk slam, and Mauro called it the deep six, which is Corbin's other move. It's definitely not a sidewalk slam. And Styles corrected him on that, but like, he didn't correct him in like a douchey heel way or mock him for it. He was just like, he was legitimately correcting a bad call. He goes like, "I don't know if that's the deep six. That looks more like a sidewalk slam to me," but I don't know. I just found it amusing for some reason. And so that was SmackDown really in a nutshell there. It was a fine show. I could have done without the Carmella segment. I thought that was atrocious, but the rest of it was pretty good. And going into SmackDown this upcoming Tuesday, these are the go-home... Are these the go-home shows? I don't know now. No, these are not the go-home shows. I thought that the Rumble was next weekend. I take that back. But we are in the final 2 weeks of build before the Royal Rumble. And they've already announced a special attraction for SmackDown this Tuesday. SmackDown is coming to Memphis. And Jerry the King Lawler is bringing back the old King's Court. His King's Court talk show segment that he debuted on TV back in 92-93. He is resurrecting the King's Court. I don't even remember the last time we had a King's Court. It might go back to the 90s. I don't ever remember them doing them when Lawler was on commentary in like the Attitude Era and after that. So this probably, I'm guessing, I could be wrong, is the first King's Court since 1994, 1995, probably. It's a long time. I actually love it. I think that's a great idea. I think that this could, you know, lead to a managerial role for Lawler on the show. And I talked about this in the mailbag a few weeks ago. Somebody asked me, do you think Jerry Lawler would make a good manager? He talked about coming back and maybe signing a talent contract, and you knew they weren't going to let him wrestle. So a manager was the only role that really made sense. Maybe this is the role that he was alluding to. Maybe he's not going to manage. Maybe he's just going to do a talk show segment. But I think that ultimately something like this could very well lead to, and who knows, maybe it's going to lead to that on Tuesday. Maybe they're only going to do one King's Court, and this is an angle to set something up for Lawler to manage someone. I mean, we'll see. I don't know who on that SmackDown brand it would be unless they put him with Ziggler. Ziggler just turned heel. Ziggler is still losing matches, but he's beating guys down with steel chairs. He's got this new attitude. He just seems to be missing something. And, you know, I don't know. Maybe a Lawler-Ziggler combo is something that could work. I'm just spitballing here. I'm not saying that this is the plan or anything, but we'll see. I don't know if we're going to get King's Court on TV week to week, or maybe it's a one-time segment to set an angle up. We'll find out on Tuesday, but I'm excited. I'm excited to see what it is, because Lawler still has the gift of gab. You know, Lawler may not be wrestling, and maybe he shouldn't be wrestling, but Lawler, I think, still definitely has something to contribute. I think he could be a manager. If it is just a talk show thing going forward, I think that's his strong suit. Lawler can talk. And if we get that heel Jerry Lawler with the one-liners and the insults, even better. We started to see some of that with Mauro Ranallo before they broke them up, and they blew up the whole SmackDown announce team, and they brought in JBL, and then they brought in Otunga. The funny thing is, for all the years that I talked about how Lawler is just mailing it in, it's not the same Jerry Lawler and all this stuff, it was in the final like weeks of his run as an announcer that we finally started to see shades of the old Jerry Lawler before they pulled the plug. So I know he still has the gift of gab. I know he still has something to contribute. And this is probably the best role for him. So I'm excited to see where they go with this.
I'm actually not wearing pants, and that's how I watch NXT every single week.
NXT this week was highlighted by a very good main event between DIY and The Revival for the tag team titles. Not as good as their other matches, but I mean, it's an unfair comparison, you know, given that those were takeover shows. This was not. This was still really good. Gargano and Ciampa retained the titles with their stereo kick to the head finish to retain the championships. The Authors of Pain attacked them from behind when the match was over and then celebrated with the tag titles, so they will challenge for the belts at TakeOver. That TakeOver card took shape on this show. You know, Billie Kay and Peyton Royce attacked Asuka in the parking lot before the show. They then opened the show with a tag team match. When the match was over, Asuka limped down to the ring to go after them, but she was outnumbered. She was just overwhelmed by the two of them. Until Nikki Cross from Sanity ran down to chase off the other two. But she's batshit crazy, and so she too attacked Asuka and left her laying. At the end of the show, Asuka barged into William Regal's office, and she says that she wants all of them. Because she was completely hysterical, and Regal's like, well, what do you want? She's like, all of them. And so it looks like it's going to be a fatal four-way, a takeover for the women's title. Could be an easy way to get the championship off of Asuka without having to beat her. Asuka has yet to be beaten. Over a year at NXT, she is undefeated. And in a fatal four-way, she doesn't have to be pinned to lose her championship. So if they wanted to get that thing off of her, this would be the time to do it. The Drifter sang us a song before coming to the ring for his match with Jonathan Cruz, which he won with the roll of the dice. You should all be very proud of me. I actually sat and watched an entire Drifter match without hitting fast forward even once. I watched the entire thing. So now my question is, does this mean that I am warming to the Drifter? Maybe I'm getting soft. I still find him fairly boring. But I am more tolerant of the Drifter. So that's an improvement. Andrade Cien Almas got his win back over Oney Lorcan. Lorcan had beaten him in Osaka, which was a surprise. And so Andrade got his win back here. I like this match. I actually like this match quite a bit. Tom Phillips conducted a sit-down interview with Shinsuke Nakamura, asking him about Bobby Roode ahead of their championship match at TakeOver in San Antonio. Nakamura said he likes Bobby Roode, thinks he's a great wrestler, but he's not strong. And he's not the king. Phillips then handed Nakamura a gift from Bobby Roode, which was Roode's ticket stub to last year's TakeOver show in Dallas, where Roode showed up for the first time in the crowd, and where Nakamura made his debut against Sami Zayn. So next week, the two of them will have a contract signing. I just don't feel, I mean, I'll do the predictions next weekend, but I'm not feeling a Bobby Roode title run. I don't think it's happening. I don't think it's happening. In fact, I think Bobby Roode is probably never going to get the championship, and probably he'll just be fast-tracked to the main roster. I mean, that's just the feeling I get. Maybe that feeling is gas, and I'll feel differently next weekend. But that's kind of where I'm going right now with my thoughts on this whole thing. I don't see Bobby Roode taking the title in San Antonio, but I also don't see Bobby Roode and Nakamura headlining the NXT show in Orlando WrestleMania weekend. I think that could be Nakamura and Cassius Ohno. And if Roode is not getting the championship, what do you do with him? Well, call him up to the main roster. Doesn't have to be the Royal Rumble. In fact, it I don't think it will be. But I think hearing that glorious theme music hit the night after, or the night after, or even WrestleMania, yeah, I could see that. I could see that, absolutely. Show ended with the DIY Revival match, which I already mentioned. Great stuff. Revival has had great matches with American Alpha. They've had great matches with DIY. Here's hoping wherever they land, hopefully SmackDown, they can do the same up there. Because they're a quality tag team. And they're a team that I was not sold on at the beginning. They won me over. They are a great old school tag team who I think could be very easily lost in the shuffle on Monday Night Raw, which is why I don't want them to go to Monday Night Raw, even though the Raw tag team division could really use a shakeup right now. I will admit, Raw probably does need new teams, and yet I just feel like the Revival would not be a good fit on that show. And so hopefully when they land on SmackDown. TNA. Poor TNA. The Fight Network in Canada, which is owned by Anthem Sports, which now owns TNA. And it seems like they're getting away from the TNA initials. They're calling it Impact Wrestling. And maybe they're finally phasing the initials down, but I still call it TNA. Anyway, Fight Network had some fans up in arms Thursday night when they accidentally aired the wrong episode of Impact on the Fight Network and I believe on their UK app as well. They aired the wrong episode. So even under new ownership, the LOL TNA moments continue. But it's not all negative. I'm not picking on TNA. There's actually positive news here I have to report on. I have to give them credit for this. They are having a huge clearance sale on their Shop TNA website starting tomorrow. They will have items going for 70, 80, even 90% off. And they may literally be giving things away for free at this rate. They may just be handing stuff to people just to get rid of it. But I mention this because of who they are bringing back for this sale. They have brought back Don West. Yes, they put a trailer up at the end of the video. Don West is back. That is awesome. I love Don West. I watched that guy in action in multiple TNA house shows back in the day when they would run MCU Park in Brooklyn, the minor league stadium here in Brooklyn. And I was always amazed that he didn't drop dead from a heart attack. That guy was working so hard. The line was still outside the building. People were waiting to get in. He was working the line, turning red in the face just to sell those brown bag specials that he used to do. And he did. He sold a ton of stuff. So if TNA has old shit that they're looking to unload, Don West is the man for the job. And apparently it was a Jeff Jarrett suggestion to bring him back. And I want to make sure I give him credit for that, because Don is the best when it comes to this kind of stuff. And I talked about Jarrett last week and how, you know, my whole thing is it's kind of dipping back into the past at a time when they need to be looking forward. But if this was a Jeff Jarrett recommendation and they got Don West back because of him, then kudos to Jeff Jarrett, because I think it's a great move on their part. Lucha Underground. This was the mid-season finale, and there is no timetable for when the show is coming back, so this will be the last Lucha Underground review on this podcast for a while. And they went out with a bang with that main event, I will say. It was supposed to be an all-night-long match, basically an Iron Man match for the entire length of the show, with Johnny Mundo defending his Lucha Underground title against the Mac, but it got changed when Dragon Azteca Jr. interrupted a meeting in Dario Cueto's office with Councilman Lorenzo Lamas. They had been talking, the two of them, about the amulet that Dario gave to Cage, and how soon we will be human again. And just all kinds of wacky shit. So Dragon Azteca barges in. He wants Matanza in a death match, which is pretty much what it was going to be anyway, right? I mean, a regular match with Matanza is pretty much a death match. So Dario and the councilman, they liked the sound of that idea. Dario picked up the phone. I don't know who he called, but whoever it was to change his main event for tonight. On commentary, Matt Stryker introduces the show. Vampiro, who has a deadly serious look on his face, cuts a quick promo warning Mil Muertes, who attacked him last week, that it won't be tonight. It may not be next week, but your time will come. Tejano pinned Joey Ryan after Famous B and the lovely Brenda made their way to the ring in the middle of the match, and the referee was distracted. Brenda slid a golden horseshoe into the ring. Tejano grabbed the horseshoe. He clocked Joey Ryan right in the face with it and got the pin. I once said, you know, Dixie Carter must have had a horseshoe up her ass because she was just the luckiest woman in the world. Well, here, Joey Ryan took one to the face. He was not so lucky. Famous B is just overjoyed because, remember, he's trying to recruit Tejano, and so he figures, well, this is surely going to help my cause, even though Tejano still wants nothing to do with this guy. Johnny Mundo, the champion, bumped from tonight's main event. He came out to cut a promo on the Mac, said that he didn't deserve a shot at the Lucha Underground title. And after several minutes of this, the Mac had heard enough. He comes out, he beats Johnny's ass before PJ Black and Jack Evans come to the rescue. But Mac gives them each a stunner. He gives security guys that come out a bunch of stunners, and I know he's been using the move for a while now, and it's kind of tongue-in-cheek and all that, but this looked ridiculous. This honestly looked like amateur hour. He came off as a poor man's indie version of Steve Austin. If Steve Austin was black and put on about 75 pounds, I'm sorry, that's what he came off as here. You know, it's like, You watch videos of people online who reenact wrestling moves, and the stunner, of course, is one of the more popular moves people like to reenact. I thought the guy was doing it kind of, maybe as like a tribute to Austin, but just like a fun thing, but he had his own like big finishing move. He really doesn't. And he's out there stunning people like he's Steve Austin, and it just took me out of the moment. And it's like, dude, come up with your own shit. Like, this is amateur hour here. This is Mickey Mouse bullshit here. I don't know why, it pissed me off. They call him Cage. Comes to the ring, wearing the Nintendo Power Glove that Dario gave him last week. He made short work of some dude named Veneno, wearing a Spider-Man mask. Basically some job guy. Now, when I saw that, and Stryker, they just flat out mentioned, who does this guy look like? Spider-Man. They actually said that on commentary, and I thought to myself, holy shit, didn't I just say a few weeks ago that the only possible payoff to this awful spider stuff with Sexy Star would be if Peter Parker himself showed up at the temple. And so here we are. We basically have Spider-Man now on TV. After the match, Sexy Star ran down and she randomly attacked the guy. She kept yelling, "It was you! It was you!" over and over and over again. Nobody in the building knew what the hell she was talking about. She looked like a raving psycho. And then the main event, Matanza and Dragon Azteca Jr. in a death match. Things got crazy when Matanza put Azteca on his shoulder. He carried him up the staircase, and now they're brawling into the crowd, which is always fun. I always love it when they do that. They brawled into the fans. Matanza chokeslammed him through the wooden bleachers. That looked terrifying. He chokeslammed him. He fell through. It looked like he fell into a black hole, never to be seen again. Dario celebrated with Matanza in the ring. They basically called the match off. Rey Mysterio shows up. Now, Rey Mysterio had warned this fucker not to take the match with Matanza because it would end badly for him, and he didn't listen. And of course, we all see what happened here. So Mysterio is very concerned, and he's just looking for people to come and help, and Matanza sees Rey Mysterio, and he just becomes enraged. And Matanza marches back up through the crowd, even punched a few fans. I put the word fans in quotation marks here for obvious reasons. And Rey and Matanza now are going at it. We got basically two matches for the price of one here. Rey ends up backdropping Matanza through the roof of one of the offices. And Dario completely freaks out. He starts ringing the bell. He tells everybody to get out. Leave the temple. Everybody out. And Mysterio is left standing tall while the others are presumed dead, I guess. I don't know. But that's how the show ended. The show ended not with that. The show ended with a segment with Mariposa and Marty the Moth. Mariposa had tied her brother up. If you remember, Marty turned on her and chokeslammed her a few weeks ago. And so we see him all tied up in a room somewhere. And he's cackling to himself, and he's trying to bite his way through the ropes, and that's how the show went off the air. That was weird. But then again, you know, Marty is a weird guy. Marty, I still maintain, Marty should have won Tough Enough. That's what Marty should have done. Marty should have won that season of Tough Enough. I think if he didn't get hurt, because I think he had like an ankle injury or something, I think he would have won that season. But I digress. Now we wait. We wait for the second half of season three. I think season three has been the weakest of the three so far. Not a bad season. I'm still enjoying it, but definitely the weakest of the three so far. For what it's worth, Melissa Santos was doing some sort of live stream on her Instagram page, either last night or the night before, and she claimed that Lucha Underground is very close to making a deal with Netflix. And I'm not sure if that would be for past seasons only or if that would include current ones. But if they could pull that off, that would be a huge coup for them. Let's get to the mailbag. If you have questions, you can email me, thesolomonster@gmail.com. Please include your name and where you are from when you write in. I wanted to just grab a whole big batch of questions this week and dive into as many as I could. So we'll start with Alex from Toronto. Jim Ross is viewed by fans as one of the greatest announcers in wrestling history. He was the voice of a generation while also heading talent relations for many years, hiring the likes of John Cena, Brock Lesnar, Batista, and others. His contributions to the wrestling industry span over 30 years. However, in WWE, he never seemed to get respect or appreciation as one of his regard should garner. He was fired multiple times, made to be humiliated with cruel humor TV segments mocking his face, and was even drafted to SmackDown as a rib on live TV without any prior knowledge. My question is, do you think JR could be the most underappreciated talent in WWE history? It's funny, you know, when I hear you mention those examples, it kind of pisses me off all over again. The whole thing with SmackDown drafting him so they could get his reaction and, you know, because they get their jollies off of that. And you mentioned making fun of his face. They didn't just make fun of his face. They made fun of his ass, literally, when he was going in for, I think, colon surgery. It was life or death stuff. They didn't know if he had colon cancer. I mean, it was a really serious situation. And that's when Vince did the whole Dr. Heine skit. And they did a lot of shit to that guy. They really did. And to answer your question, I don't think it's a matter of could he be the most underappreciated. I think he is the most underappreciated. And not by fans. The fans appreciate him plenty. He gets all the accolades from the fans. I think he's underappreciated by his employer, by Vince, by the people who hired him to do the job. And some people are going to hear this and go, well, how could he be underappreciated? He worked for the company for so many years. He was their lead TV announcer for so many years. They paid him very handsomely. He was a vice president. He wore so many hats. He wore many more hats than the black one on his head. He was, you know, handled payroll and he handled talent relations and he was part of Vince's inner circle there at the beginning for a number of years. And yes, clearly they did entrust him with a lot of responsibilities and there was a certain level of respect there. But again, I'm talking more when it comes to JR and Vince. The thing with JR is he's still underappreciated even despite all of that. They failed to see the value that he could still bring to the product. The credibility that he brought to it when he was their lead play-by-play guy. They underappreciated, I think, his ability to get over the major angles and to get over the talent and just get over the talent through his own words on TV to make things out to be a bigger deal than they probably were. He had that innate ability that just not anybody has. And Michael Cole is good enough at his job, but Michael Cole doesn't have the same ability that JR did to kind of get things over that way and make them feel special and make them feel like a big deal. And, you know, I haven't watched the UK tournament yet. I know he was doing the play-by-play with Nigel McGuinness, so I have yet to watch it. But I remember Cole doing the commentary, I believe, when they had the Beast in the East special on the network, and he was very good. Like, there's a really, really good announcer in there when it comes to Michael Cole. But again, they had the best of the best in Jim Ross. And I understand having to groom the next generation. I'm not saying that they should just, you know, not groom anybody to take that spot over at some point. And God forbid something happens to JR or he retires. Now they have nobody. And they seem to be doing a better job of that now. I get the sense that they're grooming Tom Phillips eventually to be in that spot, which is probably the only reason he's on SmackDown sitting there with the other three. But, you know, JR, here's a guy, they mocked this guy, they embarrassed this guy, and then they benched this guy. They benched their best player, which is the same thing they did with Howard Finkel. How do you bench your best player when he's still producing? It's ridiculous. I watched the Patriots last night, you know, win their game, and I'm looking at Tom Brady, and I'm thinking to myself, can you imagine if Bill Belichick just decided in the middle of this run to bench Tom Brady and put somebody else in there? We need a newer guy. We need a younger guy. We'll put Brady on the bench. You know how ridiculous that would be? And so, yes, I do think that he was, in a lot of ways, despite how handsomely he may have been paid and all the different jobs he had, I do think he was still underappreciated. I don't think that until he was gone and out of the picture, not that they were in any great rush to bring him back, but I think it bit them on the ass, and they either finally realize, or maybe they still don't realize. But we, as the fans, realize, we see what's going on here. It's not the same, you know, when it comes to being able to sell your main angles and to sell your main talent as being a big deal. There was nobody better at that than Jim Ross. Jim Ross could give that final sell, that big sell, and he was as good as anybody at that. And he was still, yeah, he was older, and he had the Bell's palsy, and, you know, wasn't the same JR from 20 years ago, but you know what? He wasn't too far off. And Jim Ross can still go out there like he does now at New Japan on Access TV. I know he's still calling matches. You know, what culture of pro wrestling will bring him in for a show? He'll do the New Japan shows on Access. He does boxing from time to time, maybe a little bit of MMA. He's still in high demand. Why? If he was old and washed up, nobody would want to use him. He's still Jim Ross. He still has that same gift that, you know, made him, like you said, one of the best of all time. And when they benched him, they did so at a time when he still had a lot left to give. And I think that right there just shows how short-sighted they were. And it shows a lack of appreciation for what he really brings to the table. And you can come up with different wrestlers who you think may have been underappreciated for their contributions. But I think they all kind of cancel each other out. I can't think of one who stands head and shoulders above the rest, which is why I'm comfortable sitting here and agreeing with you and saying, yeah, JR probably was the most underappreciated figure in that company. Emil. I think Emil from Chile. Don't you think that it would be cool to see Samoa Joe riding an elephant to the ring in his entrance at WrestleMania this year? I think he is going to receive a monster push, and riding a battle elephant to the ring would be really majestic. And Emil here has attached photos, not of Joe on an actual elephant, but of the elephants themselves. Seems to have an obsession with elephants. I don't quite know what to say to this, other than you guys know what to do. I need to see a Photoshop now of Samoa Joe riding a battle elephant to the ring. Then and only then can I accurately answer his question. So, get to work. Timothy from Texas. The Royal Rumble poster was revealed, and a lot of fans are up in arms that AJ Styles was relegated to the back row of the poster. Do you think fans are making a big deal out of nothing? Yes, I do. Who cares? Who cares? The man is defending the championship against John Cena in one of the feature matches on the card. Should the champion be that far back? No, of course not. But so what? It's one poster. It's a Royal Rumble poster. It's a Royal Rumble poster. AJ Styles is not in the Royal Rumble. You have a lot of big names in this year's Rumble. This may well be the most star-studded Royal Rumble match in many, I don't want to say going back to 92, because I don't remember all of them. I'm sure there's been some that have had a lot of big names in them. But certainly the most star-studded Rumble roster in a long time. You've got Bill Goldberg in the Royal Rumble for the first time in over a decade. You've got Brock Lesnar in the Royal Rumble. The Undertaker. All three are going to be in the same match. That's a big deal. And let's be honest here. That's the real attraction. So them being front and center on the poster to me is understandable. And the fact that AJ is in row 4 or 5 is dumb. I agree. But it's not the end of the world. And people just need to stop making such a big deal about it. Doran from Romania. I started watching wrestling since 2007, and my first memory of the first match I saw was Undertaker versus Batista at WrestleMania 23. That's what basically got me into wrestling. Along the years, I studied and watched back a lot of WWE history, and one thing I don't understand is why The Undertaker was never the guy in WWE. He has great in-ring work, the most popular character in history, great respect for the business, is very close to Vince, but he has never been portrayed as the top guy in the company. Why is this? Well, I mean, the guy looks like an undead zombie. So, you know, it's like, it's not that surprising that Vince would not want somebody like that to be on, you know, magazine covers and to be waking up at 6 a.m. to go do Today Show interviews. You know what I mean? I mean, there are certain expectations and responsibilities that they've had in their top guy going back freaking 25 years now. I mean, it's a lot more now, but even then, you had, you know, Bret Hart when he was the champ. He'd be on Regis and Kathy Lee, and he'd be doing all these different... And The Undertaker would be on that show, too, by the way. It's not like Undertaker didn't do any media. But he wasn't there as the kind of the big face and rep of the company doing as much as somebody like Bret was probably doing when Bret was on top. So I think his... I think his gimmick, more than anything, probably prevented him from ever really being the guy. And really, he was almost more of a special attraction than anything else. I mean, he was full-time on the roster and all that, don't get me wrong, but that Undertaker character was like a special attraction. I mean, Andre the Giant. Andre the Giant was a legit special attraction. He was never really the guy in WWE. Now, granted, it was a much different time back then, but I don't remember Andre ever being positioned as the guy by Vince or his dad. Because and I'm sure that a big part of that was the fact that Andre worked different territories, and so maybe that prevented him from ever really being in that role. Who knows? But back then, the closest thing to the guy was the champ. The champ was the guy. Bruno was the guy, right? Hogan was the guy. And that just was never Andre's role. He was the special attraction. So it's not exactly the same thing, but I would liken the whole Undertaker thing maybe to more of an Andre the Giant thing. And look, here's the other thing about the Undertaker that you gotta understand. There was always someone more popular. Right? I mean, there was always that one guy who was more popular. There was always somebody selling more tickets, selling more t-shirts, be it Hogan, be it Bret, be it Austin, Cena, whoever. Undertaker never moved the needle the way that a lot of those guys did, at least not in this country. He may have had a bigger following overseas. I think Ric Flair once said that, like, in the early 90s, the Undertaker was, like, super popular in Japan for some reason. But, I mean, they always had somebody who was either more of a draw or who better fit the mold, I guess, of what they were looking for in a top guy. That Undertaker character, which is absolutely 100% Vince McMahon's greatest creation, really wasn't the kind of character, I don't think, that you build your company around. And if they wanted to bring in new fans, I don't know. I mean, is the Undertaker really going to help bring in new fans? Probably not. Undertaker didn't have to be in that spot. Just like Undertaker never needed a title. It was nice to have, but he didn't need it. I mean, WWE he could be the guy who you put with the other monsters, like Yokozuna, like Giant Gonzalez, like Kane, like Great Khali. And then years later, it's funny to me, like the latter half of his career, he changed his style. He turned into this great wrestler who all of a sudden was having great matches. The Undertaker was not known for having great matches in the early to mid-90s. In fact, he had a lot of shitty matches. And that wasn't always his fault, but go back to the early days of the Undertaker, his big move was the choke. That's all he did was choke people. Now, the character evolved over time, and Undertaker started to take more risks. He would do the big suicide dive out of the ring onto a pile of people, and he evolved his character over the years. Then he became the American Badass. He started to incorporate the MMA stuff into his character, and I give him a lot of credit for that. As long as he's been around for it, it's hard. It's hard to stay relevant. It's hard to stay interesting and to change, and he did. Over and over and over and over and over again, he changed. He changed his style, he changed his music, he changed his look, his gear. And to his credit, he has stayed popular and relevant for, what, 25 years now? But he was never the guy that you built around. If you ask me, Undertaker, you know, is Undertaker the most respected? Maybe in the history of that company. The answer is a resounding yes. Yes, he is. Find me somebody who is more well-respected in that locker room than The Undertaker. Based on all the stories that everybody tells, shoot interviews and everything, it's hard to find somebody who has a bad word to say about The Undertaker. They were in the locker room with him. They all say the same thing. Undertaker was the one guy you did not want to fuck with. He was a man's man. He's a good guy. He's a leader. You hear these things over and over and over again. And you look at what the guy's put his body through. Triple H tells the story about him in the locker room strapping on the flak jacket because he had broken ribs. But damn it, he was going to go out there and wrestle. I mean, the war stories that you hear about this guy. The guy's a warrior. There will never be another Undertaker. And him not being the guy doesn't take away from any of that. But the fact is, he never was. Because there was always somebody else who was bigger than him. Vats from Calgary, Alberta. I was listening to your Royal Rumble 2015 review. In the review, you talk about how the dirt sheets that people always think are wrong for their WrestleMania predictions and cards are more often than not correct. Well, I've been reading online that the plan might not be John Cena versus Undertaker, but rather Roman Reigns versus Undertaker. Listening to your old review and how Roman was booked to break Kane's record in 2014, and the horrible booking of the Rumble in 2015, and knowing he's always present in the company's main event picture, do you agree with the idea of doing Undertaker versus Roman Reigns this year at WrestleMania? No, I think it's a bad idea, and as I talked about earlier, I don't think that is the actual plan, I really don't, and if you know, you talk about rumors and dirt sheets and all this other stuff, I mean, yeah, you're reading stuff now that says Undertaker's wrestling a Raw guy, but he's not wrestling for a championship, and I have to think that Roman is getting that Universal title back, and so I don't know that they are doing Undertaker and Roman Reigns at WrestleMania. That would seem to eliminate him from the running. That's why I think, and I talked about this earlier, if you're just listening to the mailbag, during the Raw review, I gave my whole pitch for this. I think it's Finn Balor. Finn Balor, I mean, all these other guys, if it's not Strowman, and it's not the champion, and it's not, you know, Goldberg or Lesnar or Owens or Jericho or Rollins, they're all kind of booked in their own things for WrestleMania. Balor, by process of elimination, if he's supposed to be back in March, would seem to me to be the guy. And that way you can do the dead man against the demon at WrestleMania. But if they do that match with Roman and Undertaker, I think that's a bad move. I mean, they are clearly forging ahead. Vince McMahon is forging ahead with Roman Reigns, the Roman Reigns experiment, as the top babyface, the top guy. It's not going to work, but he's going to try. And at this point, I can't even say it's Roman's fault. He's damaged goods. It's gonna take a while to kind of repair him. I think a heel turn would do that. But he's not gonna do it. He's not gonna do it. It's the same thing with Cena. Can't do it. Too afraid. Whatever his rationale is. And so, he's gonna forge ahead with Roman. And I think that it does Roman no favors. You book him in a match with The Undertaker, you are doing the man no favors. And frankly, it's not a match I want to see. I'm just, you know, maybe this is the best reason of all. It's not a match that excites me. It's not a match I want to see. I don't think it would be that much fun to watch. So I would do Reigns and Joe for the title, as I pitched earlier, and do the Dead Man Against the Demon. I think that makes for a better card at WrestleMania. Dick from One Socket, Rhode Island. Of all the celebrities I can think of that have had an impact on WWE, I can't think of one any bigger than Regis Philbin. When I look at everything he's done in WWE, be it as a backstage interviewer at WrestleMania or having wrestlers on his show to promote the company, he was always greatly adding some quality or exposure to the shows or to the company. So why isn't Regis in the WWE Hall of Fame? You've mentioned before how WWE should hurry up with inducting Demolition into the Hall because people do eventually die. And Regis at 85 perfectly exemplifies that. What reason, if any, does Regis have for not wanting to be in the WWE Hall of Fame? I don't know that he does have a reason not to be. I'm sure Regis would love to be in the WWE Hall of Fame. In fact, I've pitched Regis's name in the past as a potential celebrity inductee. I'm not sure why he's not in already. I see no reason for him not, you know, to not want to go in unless he doesn't want to do the travel because he is retired. But, you know, I got to correct you on one thing, though. You said at the beginning of your question, I can't think of all the celebrities that have had an impact on WWE. I can't think of one any bigger than Regis Philbin. I got two for you, okay? Mr. T and Mike Tyson. So let's not pretend that Regis has had this, you know, huge impact on WWE bigger than those two guys, or even Cyndi Lauper, because he hasn't. He's been a good friend of the company. He did give them a lot of exposure on his show, which was very popular back in the day. And at a time when a lot of people were still thumbing their nose at wrestling, Regis has always been a big fan, going back to, you know, classy Freddie Blassie and all that. He's talked about that before. I can remember Stone Cold Steve Austin in 98 or 99 being on Regis's show. And I don't know if he was showing him the stunner or Regis, he loved to get physical. And I think Austin popped him in the nose or something. And you know, Regis just shook it off like, no big deal. He always came off as a cool guy. Kathy Lee always came off like a bitch. And apparently she pitched a fit about Rick Rude once on the show. She's a bitch. But anyway, I like Regis. I hope he makes it into the Hall of Fame one day. That, you know, he'd be a good celebrity, I think, to put in there. He isn't getting any younger, but to insinuate that there's no celebrity who's had a bigger impact than him is laughable. And I don't think you honestly believe that. Justin, I have a question about the real-life beef between Sasha Banks and Alexa Bliss. I've heard for years that the two of them hate each other. I don't believe either one of them follows the other on Twitter. They never mention each other despite wrestling each other multiple times in NXT. And recently they had a very strange Twitter exchange that seemed to play into the notion that they could not care less about one another. Can you shed any light on their animosity? Well, I mean, it's a rumor. I've heard the rumor before. I did think it was odd. There was an interview that Alexa did a few months ago, like a written interview, maybe on .com, and she was giving credit to a lot of, it was out of character, and she was giving credit to a lot of women who have helped her and who helped her through NXT. And she specifically name dropped, if I remember correctly, Charlotte, Becky Lynch, and Bayley. And I remember reading that and thinking, and maybe some others, but I remember reading that and thinking, huh, that's, you know, Sasha's name not being there was kind of noticeable, but that in and of itself doesn't mean anything. But I've heard these rumors before. I don't know. I don't know if it's true. And if it is, I don't know what would have caused it. I have no idea. I'm as intrigued as you are. But the fact that they don't follow each other on Twitter, you know, in and of itself does not mean anything. But I don't know. I don't know what the source of tension might be there. Jake from St. Louis. I was thinking back to the breakup of The Shield, and I noticed how there was no Jannetty of the group, as all three members went on to become big stars in WWE. Has there been another team that has broken up and had all of its members go on to become big stars? You know, it's funny. I just answered another question off the air about who the Jannetty was of the team with Miz and John Morrison. And as I told that person, I don't think there was a Jannetty. I think both guys have gone on to great success. Maybe Miz more so because of the platform that he has with WWE and the exposure and the movies he's done for them. And the money I'm sure he's making, and Maurice. I don't even have to name all that other stuff. The fact that he landed Maurice makes him the biggest winner of all. So, yeah, you can argue that Miz has had more success, but Morrison's done pretty well for himself, too. This guy is the Lucha Underground champion. He is working his own dates. He's doing well for himself. Jannetty is a guy who never lived up to all of his potential and who pissed away a lot of opportunities because of his own fuck-ups. Plain and simple. The guy in a lot of ways was a fuck-up. I don't see Miz or Morrison that way at all. And so I would use them as an example. I think the biggest example I could probably think of to answer your question would be the Hardy Boys, Matt and Jeff. Right? Jeff became a huge star for a brief period of time. He's still a big star. But like Jeff Hardy in 2008, 2009, it was one of the top three most popular wrestlers in the world. And, you know, Matt Hardy never was quite at that level. Both guys had their issues. Both guys kind of went the Jannetty route for a while, including Matt. But they both come out on the other end of that as big stars. Matt now arguably more bigger than Jeff. Who would have thought? So, yeah, both guys, I think, fit that category to a T. Maybe they're the best example I can give you, would be the Hardys. I'd say Beer Money and TNA is another one. Some people are going to laugh. Oh, TNA. But, you know, yeah, okay, so TNA maybe it doesn't give them the same platform as WWE. It depends on your definition of big stars. The fact is, you know, James Storm and Bobby Roode went on to have their own singles runs, and James Storm was a world champion in TNA, even if it was only for a week or so, and Bobby Roode was champion, and now Bobby Roode landed himself a deal working for NXT, and he'll be on the main roster soon enough, and I would say both guys went on to be pretty damn successful, so yeah, Beer Money would fit in that category. I would put Future Shock and Ring of Honor in that category, Adam Cole and Kyle O'Reilly, both of whom may soon be on their way to WWE. So those are some examples off the top of my head. I'm sure people can think of some others. If you know, you want to go ahead and if this ends up on tracks, you can leave comments in the comments section, but the Hardys, to me, are the ones that stand out the most, and the other ones, I think, are also good examples. Daryl from Hartford, Connecticut, what year had your favorite final two opponents left in the ring during the Royal Rumble match? I'd have to say 2007. Undertaker and Shawn Michaels is the final two. They let them go for a few minutes. That was awesome. So yeah, 07. Brian from Baton Rouge. I was watching or rewatching King of the Ring 1993 on the network, and it struck me as... actually, let me go back here. I misread his question. He was rewatching King of the Ring 1998. There we go. On the network, and it struck me as odd that Ken Shamrock was the one who ended up winning the tournament. After the match was over, there wasn't even a coronation ceremony as they did in previous years. The pay-per-view simply proceeded to the Undertaker Mankind Hell in a Cell match. While Shamrock had a few WWF title shots here and there, he was always positioned as an upper mid-card talent with no real chance of breaking out. The Rock, on the other hand, shot into the stratosphere in popularity in 98 and became one of the biggest stars in the world. In the grand scheme of things and looking back at it now, should The Rock have won the 1998 King of the Ring? I think it may have been more of a case of they knew Shamrock was not going to get the world title. I mean, with Austin on top, there was just no way. So they knew he wasn't getting the belt. And so the King of the Ring was their way maybe that year of giving him something. It kind of reminds me of 93. In that Brett lost the championship to Yokozuna, who then lost it to Hogan. And I know the original plan, there was, you know, talk of doing Hogan and Hart at SummerSlam, and Brett's talked about that, and it never worked out. And because Hogan was resistant to that idea, I kind of feel like King of the Ring, which had been around for years as like a house show gimmick and was never a pay-per-view, I almost feel like maybe it was created specifically to give Brett something to do, and to give Brett something meaningful to kind of sink his teeth into on TV, because Hogan wouldn't do the job for him in August. I mean, I don't know what the turnaround was in terms of how far in advance they would have had to have planned for that pay-per-view, but, you know, if they knew that Hogan was not going to do the match with Brett and was not going to drop the belt to Brett, then, you know, maybe that was the whole genesis of the King of the Ring pay-per-view. I don't know. You know, I'm not sure. But here in 98, I would say that it was probably something that they knew they could just give to Shamrock. It was some kind of big accomplishment or accolade for him, and they could have Shamrock win, and they knew, they had to know, Rock was already going to go on to bigger things. I mean, Rock didn't need to win that tournament. So yeah, I don't know that Rock had to win the King of the Ring that year. Shamrock needed it a lot more than Rock did. That would be my guess. Plus, don't forget, Ken Shamrock had already failed to win the Intercontinental title from The Rock. Or he did, but then at WrestleMania, I think the decision got reversed because he freaked out. Whatever exactly it was that happened. Rock had the Intercontinental Championship, I believe, when he lost to Shamrock at the King of the Ring. He was already a champion. Shamrock never did win that belt from him, and so Shamrock had to get a big win over The Rock at some point without getting that belt, and this was probably their way of doing that. Major from Richmond, Virginia. Sitting here with my six-year-old son watching WWE Network, and his favorite match is the Empty Arena title match with Rock and Mankind. What led to the Empty Arena match, and do you think WWE / USA Network would try to compete again with the NFL halftime show, just as they did with this one? Why did they do that Empty Arena match? I'm trying to think back now. I think it was just the fact that the two of them had such a heated feud going at the time. You know, they were just coming off that I Quit match at the Royal Rumble, which was maybe a week or two earlier. The idea, I guess, my sense is the idea was it's too dangerous to have anybody around for it. And I mean, remember, this was being promoted as a halftime gimmick during the Super Bowl. They had to make people think this was going to be such a dangerous match. It could go anywhere and nobody was safe. And so, yeah, the only way to keep it safe was for everybody else, to be gone, you know, let these guys kill each other in an empty arena with no fans and in any kind of jeopardy. I mean, I loved it. I think it's one of the most entertaining things they've ever done. I still crack up laughing when I see Rock throwing bread in Mick Foley's face and calling him a fat fuck. Or when Rock was taking phone calls in the office as he's kicking the shit out of Mankind. Now, the ending of the match was really corny. I was not a fan of the ending so much, although that shot with the camera of like Rock's facial expressions as he's trapped under the wooden pallet was kind of funny. But it was corny as all hell. The rest of it, though, I loved. And you had Vince McMahon back on commentary. Now, I know not everybody is a big fan of Vince McMahon's commentary, but I like Vince McMahon on commentary. And so there you go. I mean, that's all the reason you need, right? How can you not like that? So would they compete against the NFL now, I think was your other question. Apparently not, since they haven't tried anything like that again, right? It's going to be 20 years. If they were going to compete, I would think they would have tried it by now. Steve from the UK, I was rewatching WrestleMania 8, and I had a thought about the Flair Savage match. When Elizabeth came out during the match, Bobby Heenan came out with a line saying, "Is she on the side of the Macho Man, or is she on the side of Ric Flair?" Did he actually say that? I don't remember that. That's kind of like the Bash at the Beach thing when Hogan came out. Whose side is he on? Anyway, he says, it got me thinking, do you think they considered turning Elizabeth heel and siding her with Flair? Elizabeth left the company soon after this match, and she and Randy soon divorced, so surely Elizabeth turning her back on Savage would have made sense if she was leaving anyway, and it would make the rivalry between Flair and Macho Man even bigger. Well, I doubt they knew that she was on her way out. I mean, I think they got divorced many months later. I don't think that's something that they had a heads up on, you know, like 6 months in advance. I have no idea if they considered it or not. I think that might be a question better posed to Bruce Pritchard for his podcast. But I'll tell you what. It would have been a hell of an idea to keep that Flair Savage feud going, which I loved. I thought it was a great feud. Savage, you know, I gotta say, Savage's best days in the ring, you could argue, were behind him after he lost that retirement match at WrestleMania to the Ultimate Warrior, and he took all those months off. Supposedly he was trying to start a family with Elizabeth, and he had to get off all the stuff that he was on, and they never did have kids. But when Savage came back, he had the feud with Jake the Snake, which is one of my all-time favorite feuds. As much as people agree with me and they think it was great, I still think it's underrated and underappreciated. It did not last very long. The matches were not very good. But just as a feud, as a personal rivalry, I thought it was awesome. And Savage went right from the Jake feud into the feud with Flair and the whole she was mine before she was yours thing heading into WrestleMania 8. Savage was tied up with some good shit at the end of 91, beginning of 92. The Flair-Savage feud, it actually did go on for many more months, But I feel like it was just stagnant. Like, Savage won the championship at WrestleMania. They had that great pull apart after the match. Just great, great stuff when Flair kissed Elizabeth and she slapped him and everything. And then when the match was over, and some people, you know, ask me sometimes, where do your clips in your intro come from? And there's a Randy Savage clip in there. And one of the clips I use in my intro is from that post-WrestleMania 8 match interview where he's like, you know, you haven't been beat up properly. He was just a man incensed, even though he had just won the championship. So the feud did continue for many more months, but it just kind of, there was a lull where there really wasn't a whole lot going on. And the next championship match Savage had wasn't even against Flair, it was against the Warrior. So I think having Elizabeth go heel and side with Savage helped Flair win the match and retain the championship at WrestleMania, which would extend Flair's title run. Because Flair's title run only went from the Rumble to WrestleMania. It's not very long at all. So you can actually keep his title run going. It infuses some new juice into the whole thing. I think that would have been a hell of an idea. Now, if they were still married, I doubt Savage would have gone for it. And it looks like they were already having problems in their marriage, so I don't know that a heel turn for her would have been the best thing for them at the time. But that would have been a pretty cool twist, I think, on that whole storyline. You know, they kind of tease showing the giant centerfold of her, right? Perfect and Flair were teasing, when we win at WrestleMania, we're going to drop the centerfold. And they wanted you to think they had, like, naked pictures of her or something. And so when I was younger, I'm thinking, man, I want Ric Flair to win this match. And they never did drop the centerfold. But what they could have done was they could have had her turn on Savage. And then we find out that there never was a centerfold. Because I always wondered, like, all right, Flair lost, but why didn't they just drop the damn centerfold? Like, in this case, it would kind of make sense. She turns heel and they reveal, well, there never was one. She was with us the whole time. There never was a centerfold. And Flair, like I said, he gets to keep the belt for a few more months, and then he can drop it to Savage at Wembley Stadium. But I guess they wanted to save the big title change for the Brett Davey Boy match on that card. Jacob from Warrnambool, Australia. Other than the 1992 Royal Rumble match, because we all know how much you love it, what are your three favorite Royal Rumble matches? And your three favorite returns in the Rumble match? For my three favorite Rumble matches, I feel like I've answered this before. Other than 92, I would go, and this is not in any kind of order or anything like that, I would probably go, well, with 2005 for sure. I'm a big fan of the 2005 Rumble match. That actually might be my second favorite of all the Rumble matches, so I'd go with 05. I'd probably go with 2001 and 2008 at Madison Square Garden, which was the first Rumble I ever attended live. As far as returns go, I would go with Mr. Perfect in 2002. And I love how he was not only back in the Rumble after all these years away, I think he was part of the final, like, three or four. He was in there at the end with, like, Kurt Angle and Steve Austin and Triple H. So, you know, he felt like a big deal. So I would say Perfect is one. And by the way, why he never got a singles match at WrestleMania that year, I'll never know. He was in some meaningless multi-man pre-show bullshit. Mr. Perfect should have had a match at WrestleMania that year. John Cena in 2008 would be another one. I was there in the building when his music hit and he came out at number 30. It was just insanity. And it took, I'd say, maybe 20 to 30 seconds until he hit the ring for the crowd to realize, hey, wait a minute, we hate this guy, and then they all started booing him. And the third return, if I had to pick another one, would be Diesel. Diesel in 2011. Yes, I marked for a Kevin Nash return in the Royal Rumble match. I didn't mark as hard as Matt Stryker did, which cost him his job. But yeah, I thought that was actually pretty cool. I thought that was very cool. Now, in my defense, it was more for his old Roseanne theme music than it was anything else. Dylan from Toronto. I'm one of your listeners who no longer watches the product, only listens to your podcast to keep up. With all the hype about Wrestle Kingdom 11 and Kenny Omega, I had to check the match out. It lived up to the hype and it was amazing. So, with WWE's attitude of, if you don't like it, don't watch it, What would you think about next year, be it out of protest or maybe just checking off a wrestling bucket list item? What if you went to Wrestle Kingdom 12 instead of WrestleMania? Well, Dylan, you asked me that any other year, I might consider it. Next year, though, come on, brother. I just got done talking about New Orleans. They're going back to New Orleans next year. Of course I'm going to New Orleans. We already have our house booked. Are you kidding me? I'm going to skip out of New Orleans next year? Are you out of your mind? No, I'm not. I'm going to New Orleans next year. Maybe I could swing both. I don't know how I would afford it. I would love to go to a Wrestle Kingdom show. I would love to go to Japan and check out the sites and check out, what was it, Ribera Steakhouse or whatever. All the wrestlers get their jackets there. I'd love to go to Japan. I really would. And to check out whether it's Wrestle Kingdom or if it's a show at, like, I don't know, Korakuen Hall or Sumo Hall and some of these other, like, more intimate buildings that they have there. You know what? You talk about, like, a wrestling bucket list. That would be a good question to actually throw back to you and everybody listening. And maybe this would be a good clip even to get up on tracks and get people's feedback. If you had a wrestling bucket list of however many items, 5 items, 3 items, 10 items, whatever, what would be on your wrestling bucket list of things that you would like to do before you die? That would be an interesting question. Because for me, going to Japan or going to a Wrestle Kingdom show, yeah, I would put that on my list. Absolutely. I mean, I'm not a fan of flying to whatever it is, 15 hours to get there. But yeah, I've always wanted to go to Japan. And yeah, maybe one of these days I'll actually have that opportunity. I would love to check it out at some point. But I'm not gonna do it at the expense of my New Orleans trip. Now, maybe if Mania the following year goes to, like, Minneapolis or something. No offense to the people in Minnesota. That might be the year to do it. But, yeah, I'd be curious to find out what's on everybody's list. Alex has a buy or sell. Eddie Guerrero or Chris Benoit? Boy, that's a loaded question. Huh. Eddie Guerrero or Chris Benoit? Benoit definitely came into WWE the much bigger star. I think he got a championship match in his first week. He had some incredible matches, but so did Eddie. See, the thing with Benoit made his matches feel more real. People talk about the Japanese strong style. Chris Benoit brought strong style to the States. I mean, he was one of those guys anyway. He had a very strong, stiff style. He made his matches just feel more real. He was more aggressive, which is kind of creepy to say, looking back at how his life ended. But, I mean, he was a very aggressive guy, and he had this aggression that just made everything he did look absolutely brutal. And he was a damn good wrestler, one of the best that there's ever been. But I think what he lacked in personality, and what he lacked in showmanship, Eddie Guerrero more than made up for it. I mean, Eddie was just fun to watch. I feel like as the total pro wrestling package, in-ring work, if that's important to you, charisma, personality, promos, like all of it put together, I got to buy on Eddie Guerrero and sell on Chris Benoit. I don't think either one of them on their own was much of a draw, like, as world champion. In fact, Eddie beat himself up over that fact when they took the belt off him a few months later. He blamed himself for the SmackDown attendance not being up to snuff and all that kind of stuff. And that's really not fair, because wrestling is a lot different now than it used to be back then. I mean, 20, 30 years ago, yeah, your name was the top name on the marquee. Business probably lived or died based on how you performed. You know, Bruno Sammartino with all those sellouts at Madison Square Garden, Hogan pretty much wherever he would go, Flair back when he was the traveling champion for the NWA. I mean, you had a lot of really hot guys back then in terms of how popular they were, but those guys, you put their name on the marquee, and those were the difference makers. And I don't know that in wrestling today we have, I don't know, we have as many in the way of difference makers. It's more about the brand. Like, WWE is coming to town. It's not Roman Reigns is coming to town. It's not AJ Styles is coming to town. So it's just very different now. And so I think even when Eddie was the champion, it was already kind of like that, where it was more about the brand. It wasn't so much about who the champion was on top on the marquee or in the advertising and that kind of stuff. Neither one of them were like big megastars or anything like that. And I think it was probably a case of Eddie being too hard or harder on himself than he probably should have been, because it wasn't all his fault. But I know he beat himself up over that. And Benoit, I'm not aware of Benoit exactly lighting the world on fire business-wise when he was the champion, although he had a longer run with the belt. But the fact is, if either one of those guys were that hot when they were the champion, they would have kept the belt on him a lot longer. And they never would have put it on JBL. And with Benoit, it's like, as soon as those guys got the title, they were already looking forward at someone newer or younger to put the belt on. Not that JBL was so much younger, but you know, the JBL gimmick was something new. They were trying to get him over as a new star. Randy Orton, obviously, they always had big plans for him. So I think when it comes to who is a draw, if that's kind of part of your question, who was a bigger star and all that, between the two of them, it's pretty much a wash, because neither one was really that big of a star or big of a draw. I just think Eddie overall was much more entertaining. He was more of a complete package than Benoit was. So that's why I'm going to buy on him. And one more question here, a non-wrestling question. Patrick from Chino Hills, California. Who wins in this Hall & Oates three-way dance? Maneater versus Out of Touch versus One-on-One. Three of my favorite Hall & Oates songs. My pick is Out of Touch because of the music video that had that giant drum that John Oates was playing. What say you? Well, Out of Touch is one of my favorite songs ever, like all time. So obviously I'm picking that one. I have to say, though, it's kind of timely I get your question. I started using Spotify Premium. I was using Spotify and Pandora for free, and I just got pissed off at all the commercials. So I decided I'm gonna pay for Pandora for a month. We'll see how it is. And if I don't like it, I'll pay for Spotify, and I'll see how it is. I was always a Pandora guy. I have done a complete 180 now. Spotify kicks Pandora's ass. And I happily pay for it every month now. And one of the things that came up in a playlist for me was Adult Education, which is a Hall & Oates song. And it's not a song that I knew very well, like when I was a kid. As a kid, it was always like Maneater and Out of Touch, because my mother had a VHS cassette tape with all of the music videos on there. And I used to play, I wore that thing out so much. And I had a mic stand. I had a microphone, and I'd be 5 years old walking around the living room with a toy microphone in my hand singing frickin' Hall & Oates songs. Which, by the way, there is video that exists of this, and if I have anything to say about it, it will never see the light of day, but it does exist. I did see it again recently. It is in my possession. But anyway, so this Adult Education song comes on. I'm like, man, I haven't heard this in a long time. And it's the remastered version from 2003, so it's got like some extra beats in it. I love this fucking song. It's great. And I think it's an underappreciated song, because you hear Hall & Oates, you think of like, what do you think of? You think of Rich Girl, you think of Sarah Smile, which I don't like at all. You think of all these other songs, and you never really hear about this one. I like this song. I think it's really good. In fact, it might be my second favorite Hall & Oates song right now. So anyway, I'm sure many of you have no idea what I'm talking about, nor do you give a shit. But for those of you who do, check out that remastered version of the song. It's pretty cool. And now, I have a note here to talk about one more thing before we wrap up. A quick history note that I wanted to mention before I talk about the whole This Week in Sound Off history and I sign off here. It was 24 years ago this past week that Monday Night Raw debuted on USA, January 11, 1993. Which it was a show that opened with Yokozuna squashing Coco Beware, and it closed with The Undertaker beating Damian Demento. So WWE was still the land of the giants in a lot of ways. I mean, less so by 93. Bret and Shawn were kind of on their way up, and a lot of the big roided up monsters were either deflated or they just weren't around anymore. They went to go work somewhere else. But it was always the land of the giants in WWE. Contrast that with what we saw at the end of Raw 3 years ago this past week. January 13, 2014. Daniel Bryan breaks free from the Wyatt family. Daniel Bryan, who is probably, I'm guessing, a legit 5'8", 5'9", which is what I am. I mean, I interviewed him, and we stood head-to-head. I think we were pretty much the same size. So he's about 5'8", 5'9", legit. I don't care what they build him as on TV. He had that crowd hanging on his every move in what will go down as one of the all-time greatest moments in Raw history. The storyline was kind of dumb. I mean, here's a guy who, at the time, he had gotten himself over with the audience way more than the company ever would have imagined. Whatever it was, I mean, they got behind this guy. They decided he's our guy. We like him, and we're going to get behind him. And so through August and September and October into November, and November turned to December, and December turned to January, and here is by far the hottest act in the entire company being hypnotized into joining the Wyatt family, being a slave to Bray Wyatt. It was dumb. I thought it was a dumb idea. And clearly he was being phased out of the title picture. He had his time, and now the company had other plans. You're not going to fuck with our plans. We're moving on. Right? Batista was on his way back. He was going to win the Royal Rumble. He was going to challenge Randy Orton for the championship at WrestleMania. This big triumphant return. And you just thought to yourself, that can't be right. Surely Vince McMahon sees what they have here in this guy. It's not every day that somebody comes along getting the kind of crowd reactions that this guy was getting. But it didn't seem like they were getting the message. Not until the Royal Rumble, when Bryan wasn't even in the Rumble match, and the crowd shat on pretty much everybody. Ironically, everybody except Roman Reigns, which is kind of funny to look back on now. Then CM Punk had enough. He said, fuck you, I quit. And it was only then that they were forced to change all of their plans, and all of a sudden Daniel Bryan got upgraded from wrestling Sheamus six matches down to wrestling twice on one show and winning the championship in the main event. And I say, you know, good on WWE for doing the right thing in the end. It all worked out. But I think back to what happened on that Raw show 3 years ago. And it amazes me that even after that, they still didn't get it. It still took the crowd shitting all over Batista and Punk walking out to get Daniel Bryan into that top spot. There was a cage match on the show. Bryan was teaming with Bray. He had been doing the Wyatt thing for a few weeks. Really not that long at all. Randy Orton's been doing the Wyatt thing a lot longer than Bryan ever did. Somewhere in that match, Daniel Bryan gets concussed. I don't know what spot it was, but he gets concussed. They finish the match. After the match, Bryan is in a trance. The only men in the cage are the referee, Daniel Bryan, and Bray Wyatt. Bray goes to give him Sister Abigail, and Bryan swats him away. And for the next, I don't know, maybe 5 minutes, Raw became something I have not seen since the Attitude Era, when you used to have those loud crowds that just screamed and shouted, and they were there to have fun. They were there to see Stone Cold, you know, drink beer and stun people. They were there to see The Rock talk about eating pie and DX telling people to suck it and Sable walking around with her tits hanging out, right? It was like a giant party. People went to Raw because it was cool, because it was the in thing to do, and because it was fun. And they had people that they could get behind. And here, these people were behind Daniel Bryan. They were behind him in a way that I honestly have not seen since those days. I have not heard a crowd like that on Raw since those days. And when he started to fight back against Bray, the place just exploded. When he gave him the kicks and everybody chanted yes, and Harper and Rowan were locked out of the cage and they couldn't do anything about it. When Bryan did the yes thing in the corner where he started out real slow and then he picked up speed, and they got this great shot. The camera panned out and they got this great wide shot from the hard camera of the crowd. the entire crowd doing the yes chant, starting slowly and then getting quicker and quicker and quicker and doing it all in unison. And he gave Bray the running knee and he climbed to the top of the cage, concussed, mind you. And he did the yes thing from up there and everybody did it along with him. I still get goosebumps when I watch that back. And it's a shame he probably doesn't remember any of it because of the concussion. And I think he's even said he doesn't remember any of it. But it's stuff like that that keeps me watching that show. That was an incredible segment. And everybody should go back and watch it if you want to see what it's like to actually have a crowd that is invested and that cares with a guy that people actually want to get behind. Not because they told you to like him, but because they wanted to like him. That was 3 years ago this week, and it's every bit as awesome to go back and watch that now as it was then. Some other history notes. This week in Sound Off history, this is of course episode 478 as I record, but episode 78 from August 8th, 2009, I talked about the infamous appearance of Jeremy Piven and Dr. Ken on Raw, who were there to promote a new film they were in called The Goods. And they sure didn't bring the goods to this show. Piven not only threatened to ban The Miz from Raw for all of eternity, which is a very long time, but he threatened to ban The Miz from the Summerfest. Now, he meant to say SummerSlam, but he's an actor. So it's not like you can expect this guy to remember his lines or anything. Funny thing about that is, and I didn't realize this until I went back and actually listened to some of the old show. But apparently, the year before this, so this would have been 2009, in 2008, WWE actually did host an event called Summerfest. It was right before SummerSlam in 2008, so. But I doubt very seriously that that's what Jeremy Piven was referring to. Episode 178, from September 11th, 2011. I talked about the 10-year anniversary of the 9/11 attacks and made very good use of the freedoms given to us by absolutely tearing WWE and TNA to shreds. Raw for being an embarrassment of a show. I see some things never change. Kurt Angle being arrested for his third DUI while under contract and TNA doing nothing about it. And I made the case for why Hulk Hogan, Ric Flair, Eric Bischoff, Kurt Angle, and Jeff Hardy should all be fired from TNA. And the one legend who I thought deserved to stay. So that's a podcast, episode 178, where I held nothing back on that show. And that's a good one to go back and listen to. Episode 278 from June 12th, 2013 was a special edition of the Sound Off marking the 20th anniversary of the very first King of the Ring pay-per-view. This is the show, if you ever wanted to know about the history of the King of the Ring dating back to the 80s, which is long before it morphed into a pay-per-view, that's the podcast to go back and listen to. I talked about all the tournaments from the 80s, all the pay-per-views from 93 onward. I also talked about who the tournament helped, who it hurt, and whether or not it should be brought back. And episode 378 from April 12th, 2015 talked about some WWE talent being upset with the fans over their treatment of Roman Reigns. Also, did the Attitude Era hurt the wrestling business long term, which is something Jim Cornette had suggested. I ranked my top three favorite Money in the Bank cash-ins on that show. And Alex Riley won Sad Tweet of the Week honors back on episode 378. You can go back in the archives if you want to listen to any of these episodes. TheSolomonster.com is the place to go. There are a fair number of episodes that are not available right now in the archives that go back to like 2008. I have all the episodes, but a lot of the early ones are not online. You can find the first 10 sound offs I ever did up on our YouTube channel. I have put them up there. And the other ones will, you know, gradually over time, you'll probably be able to download the other ones. I see that WWE 2K17 is coming to PC next month. It's like $50. I don't remember the last. I must have gotten 2K16 on sale because I didn't pay no $50 for it. And based on all these reports I'm reading about all the glitches and everything in 2K17, I ain't paying $50 for this one. So I'm in no rush to buy it. If you guys ever happen to notice one of those Steam sales, you want to let me know. Price comes down. Maybe then I could pick it up. Otherwise, I see no problem with doing more Sound Off Gamer videos using 2K16. In case you haven't noticed, I still haven't quite mastered that one yet. Maybe I should try to do that first. Don't forget to vote in the Wrestling Radio Awards. This is the last call. The deadline to vote is this Thursday, January 19. If you want to help the Sound Off become Show of the Year, 3 years in a row, we are nominated in 4 different categories, including Show of the Year, plus Male Interview of the Year with Bob Holly, Female Interview of the Year with my Katrina interview, and Media Interview of the Year with my Diamond Dallas Page interview. So please go to WrestlingRadioAwards.com. You can use the free ballot on the main page. You don't have to pay for anything. You can vote once a day in each category every day between now and, I guess, the end of the day on Thursday. So go ahead and check that out. There's a lot of good shows in contention this year. A lot of other categories as well. For example, there's a category Best New Show. You know, I've been showing some love for Off the Script with JD from New York. There's another category that has the Best Broadcast Show. I think that Damian Nelson does a great job with the Pro Wrestling Report, PWR. You might want to show him some love. I've seen Damian a couple of times over WrestleMania weekend. Hopefully I'll see him again this year in Orlando and again in New Orleans next year. So anyway, if you want to go vote, WrestlingRadioAwards.com is the place to go for that. Don't forget, join the private group on Facebook if you want to be part of the Royal Rumble pool. The post that Zach Holker put together for the pool should be pinned to the top of the page. If it's not, just do a search in the group. Type in Zach Holker, you'll find it. Excuse me. And also, he is going to be posting the numbers once they are assigned to everybody. That'll be next weekend. But you can still like the original post if you want to be entered into the Rumble right up until a few hours before the pay-per-view, provided we get at least 30 people per pool. You can still get in on the fun. And if you are not in the group, you got to search for it. It's just Solomonster Sounds Off. You will see the header photo, which is the Rumble Like It's 1992 logo that we have on one of our t-shirts on Pro Wrestling Tees. If you see that banner, that is the group. That's the group you want to apply for. Shoot me a message and let me know that you've done so, and I'll get you in there. And we'll be back with a brand new podcast next weekend. That'll be episode 479. Wow, we're getting awfully close to 500. I got to come up with some special plans here for Sound Off 500. I got to start thinking about that. I'm hitting all these milestones, right? Hit the 9-year anniversary. This year is going to be our 10-year anniversary in November. Episode 400 was kind of a big deal for me. Now already 500's around the corner. It's pretty cool. And it's possible because you guys have made this show such a joy for me to do and such a success. You've spread the word. You've gotten other people to listen to it. TV Tracks, I can't thank him enough for being a fan and spreading the word of the Sound Off on his channel. I will be forever indebted to him for that. You can make a PayPal donation. You can use our Audible link, buy a t-shirt. Lots of different ways to support this podcast. But most of all, just keep listening. Hopefully you'll listen next weekend too. We'll be back with episode 479. Until then, be well, stay safe, have yourselves a great week. And we will see you back here for more Sound Off next weekend. Until then, take care, guys.
The good, the bad, and the ugly. The Solomonster Sounds Off.
This Impact show has moved so many times. It's got more fucking moves than Bruno Mars, this show does. Don't believe me, just watch. Impact started out on Friday, then moved to Saturday, Thursday, then they moved it to Monday. They got slaughtered, so they moved it back to Thursday, then they moved it to Wednesday, Friday again, then back to Wednesday, Tuesday, and now back to Thursday. It's like the Big Show of TV shows. It's turned 1,000 times already, and the only time people pay any attention to it is when it makes them laugh.
Solomonster Sounds Off. Since 2007, the Solomonster Sounds Off. Available at thesolomonster.com, Stitcher Radio, TuneIn Radio, iTunes, and more.
Solomonster Sound Off.